Good evening, everyone. Welcome. My name is Bill Krim. I'm the president and CEO of United Way of Salt Lake. And on behalf of KUER and United Way of Salt Lake, we want to welcome you here tonight for the second in our speaker series, It Starts With You. When we first thought about doing this, I don't think we could have imagined how important discussions like this would be at this particular time. And I want to say the discussion isn't the only thing. The purpose of this, we hope, is to catalyze or support action that addresses what we see going on in our world today. Thank you all for being here. We deeply, deeply appreciate it. If you are Twitter people, if you have a Twitter handle, if you know how to tweet, then we'd like to invite you to do that. Tweet your ideas for actions that we can take as individuals to combat the racism and the divisiveness that we see in our country. We invite you to do that and to tag at UWSL, at KUER underscore FM, and it starts with you. Hashtag it starts with you. There will be one more speaker series event November 1st at the Rose Wagner Theater, not at this location. Our final speaker series event will feature Claudio Sanchez, education correspondent for NPR Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition. He's also a former elementary and middle school teacher. You can go online and reserve your tickets and register at speakerseries.uw.org beginning September 5th. Finally, I want to thank the sponsors that make this event possible. Our presenting sponsors, Dominion Energy and Bank of America Merrill Lynch, our major sponsor, Comcast, and our supporting sponsors, Parsons, Bailey, and Latimer, and Aspira Public Affairs. And finally, I'd like to thank KUER for being such an amazing partner and introduce Maria O'Mara, General Manager of KUER, and thank you again for all being here.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, all of you, for being here tonight. I have the great honor of introducing our guest tonight. In preparation, I listened again to the This American Life episode this morning on my way into work, The Problem We All Live With. Nicole Hannah-Jones' work was not unfamiliar to me, but for some reason, listening to it this morning, I was struck by the emotional impact of the reporting. I had remembered being struck by the context and the attention to data in her work, but I'll just be real honest, I was a big hot mess on the drive in. I got very emotional listening, especially to a mother and her junior high school daughter, and it might have had something to do with the fact that I dropped my daughter off for seventh grade the day before. There could have been a connection there, I don't know. But I am so glad to share an appreciation with Nicole, with all of you, for the power and intimacy of radio reporting. The reporting that Nicole Hannah-Jones has done over the last 5 years, focusing on racial segregation in housing and schools, maintained by official action and policy, is a real gift to this country and to our community. It has, of course, been very well recognized. Nicole is the recipient of the Peabody Award, George Polk Award, National Magazine Award, among many others. Before joining the New York Times, Nicole worked for ProPublica. She has also been heard or seen in The Atlantic, Essence Magazine, Politico, and of course on This American Life, Face the Nation, and NPR. Interviewing Nicole tonight as one of KUER's own reporters, Lee Hale began listening to our station when he was teaching English at a middle school in West Jordan. It's that commute that gave him careful listening time to appreciate public broadcasting. Inspired by what he heard, Lee applied for the Kroc Fellowship at NPR headquarters in D.C., and a new career was born from teacher to reporter. Lee returned to Utah just this past October and joined our station. I honestly can't imagine our station without him. He covers both education and faith here in our community. Ladies and gentlemen, Lee Hale and Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Uh, You know how when you meet somebody you've heard on the radio and you get a little starstruck because you finally see a face with a voice? The This American Life episode that you did, Nicole, was one of my favorites.
Thank you.
And I called you on the phone last week to chat, and I had to take a moment because I had to get in the right headspace. That was the same voice. So it happens to us too. You know, we work in it, but it's still exciting to meet people we admire. Talking about race is tricky, but you've chosen to make a career out of it. You write about race, you write about education. Why the willingness? Why the willingness to go into that topic, which a lot of us get a little squeamish about, a lot of us have a hard time with?
So I wanted to write about race since I was in high school, when I joined my high school newspaper. I think it's interesting, actually, when I was in the reception earlier, someone came and asked me, why is it so hard for us to talk about race? And I said, it's not hard for Black people to talk about race. Black people talk about race constantly because, you know, race is the defining element of our experience in this country. And I think it is much harder for white Americans because white Americans can largely ignore race. They don't necessarily have to acknowledge the way that race shapes nearly every institution in our country. And it's uncomfortable because the history of race in this country is a difficult one. It is a history that defies our belief in the United States as an exceptional country. For millions of people, the United States was not a democracy. And I think that that is a hard thing for many white Americans to grapple with. So I actually turned the question back on the people who asked me that, and I was like, you have to tell me why.
I guess it told you more about me than anything else, right?
Why it's so hard for white Americans to talk about race, because I think Black Americans, again, are always talking about it. And I think it's because it's fraught. People don't want to make a mistake. Yep. People don't want to say the wrong thing. People don't want to be called racist. And so it becomes this point of tension where I think a lot of people do want to understand, but are very afraid to have the conversations. And a large part of that is that we are a very segregated society. And so when you have a lot of white Americans who have never grown up around Black Americans, who haven't had intimate relationships, then the opportunity to have these conversations has been rare. And that means when the opportunity presents itself, it's hard to have an honest conversation because I think white people are very afraid of making a mistake. And also just, frankly, don't understand a lot of the necessary context to have the conversation.
And you've done a little reporting about how some people, the cop-out is like, well, aren't we kind of in a post-racial America?
Well, I don't think anybody's saying it anymore.
Okay. And I guess that, to my point, especially in the last few weeks.
I feel like we've been firmly disabused of that notion.
Right. And I guess I was looking at an article you'd written around the election time.
Yes.
And how this last year we have to talk about race, especially since Charlottesville is the time where you hear a lot of people talking about race, maybe reluctantly, but they're still talking. When that happens, when there's an event that demands a conversation about race, you're somebody that's always talking about race. What do you listen for when everyone else starts chiming in?
So I think the conversations about Charlottesville, the condemnation of what happened in Charlottesville is the easiest thing. Right, it's easy to say we condemn white supremacy, we condemn neo-Nazis, we condemn people who hate Jews and hate Black folks. And everyone can feel really good about that. But my work is looking at all of the racial inequality and racism that we accept every day and that we don't call out, which is when we don't want a lot of Black people to move into our community, or we don't want to send our children to a school with lots of Latino kids. And very progressive people are willing to accept that. So I think the benefit of something like Charlottesville is, of course, with the election of the first Black president, many white Americans wanted to believe that we were done. We have finally moved past race. We don't want to talk about it anymore. If a Black person can be in the White House, race is clearly not a problem. And Charlottesville shows that that is not true, and I think that's important. But I think what's much more important is not to call out the most violent. I mean, someone died in Charlottesville. If you can't call that out, that's your president, so.
Right.
If you can't call that out, I think that that's, you know, you're a different type of person. But I think it is the everyday racial injustice and the way that race motivates everyday decisions that is much more difficult. And I would like to see us focus more on that.
Yeah, and I'm just gonna make an assumption that people in this room tonight are people that wanna get it right. You know, you're careful, you're thoughtful, and reluctant still. My colleague Sam Sanders at NPR, he did a podcast about Charlottesville. He does a podcast called It's Been a Minute. and he's black, and he just chose to have only white guests because his thinking was, you can't just rely on me anymore. I might be your black friend, but you need to start having conversations amongst each other about race. You can't just like touch base with your black friend after something atrocious happens and say, that's not me, I'm good, right? You have to be willing to talk with your white friends about race.
And yourself.
So how do you, I mean, what are those initial conversations sound like? What would be a good place to start if you're somebody who wants to be a little more willing or a little more open? What do you think that looks like?
You tell me. No. So I think that...
Is the mic on?
Is it on? Yes. I think that first it requires... let me start by saying, we most Americans, no matter what race you are, have no idea how we got here, right? We're not taught history very well. We don't have a real understanding. And even when we're taught history, race is very marginalized, and we don't understand the way that race and racism... Is this going in and out? Donald Trump must have heard me. Secret Service is like cutting my mic right now. No, clearly I'm not that important. But I think we don't understand that so the work that I'm doing is, it's not saying that white folks are bad. Like, nobody wants to think that they're a bad person. It's saying that you don't have to do a single thing for the systems to replicate. I mean, the systems were set up. And so it's not even about someone being a good or a bad person. It's about, are you willing to disrupt the systems that are set up? And I think that is a very hard thing, because no one wants to hear, like, our history is bad. People like me did a lot of bad things. People like me are still doing bad things. So I think that is the challenge. But it's also then the challenge is, you have to acknowledge that this history is happening and that there are unearned advantages. And that if you truly want equality, some of that advantage you have to let go of. And I don't think white Americans are willing to have that honest conversation.
And that's the why, right? The why.
Of course, that's the why. So when I talk about school segregation, the thing I say is, like, black people can't fix this. Brown people can't fix this. We didn't cause it. We don't want it. It doesn't benefit us. White Americans are the ones who have to fix it, but white Americans are the ones who have the least reason to want to fix it, because segregation is a benefit. Mm-hmm. And so when you ask, like, what are the conversations that should be had, frankly, I'm largely disinterested in conversations, because unless those conversations are moving people to action. I spend most of my time in the classrooms of segregated schools where children who we have promised that schools will be the great equalizer are in schools that are actually harming them, that are actually ensuring that they will never have opportunity. And so when people want to keep having a conversation about race, I actually would prefer that people, like, do something right about all of these children who are in these schools.
Yeah, I think they agree. And the thing I love about school is it gives you a platform, right? I mean, these are obviously, this affects every facet of the community, but a school is where you can see it kind of cut and dry sometimes. This is the disadvantage of being separated.
Yes.
When you don't have diversity, kids suffer. And yes, white families, white children benefit from segregation in some ways, but it also harms them. I know a lot of your reporting is showing people that there are advantages. You have an amazing article that puts your family on the spot. And I'm sure that was very uncomfortable for you to write.
Yes.
Because you're used to not being in the spotlight. But this question of segregation came to your neck of the woods in Brooklyn. You had to confront it. And you, in the article, you mention your husband, how he grew up in a very diverse education environment and the kind of benefits of that. Can you just explain that a little bit?
Sure. So the article is about... So I've written about school segregation for a long time, mostly not as a mother. And it's very different to say what people should do when you don't have a child of your own that you're having to make decisions about. So I have a child, and then I moved to New York City, which many people don't know is the most segregated major school system in the country. It is the third most segregated city residentially in the country. It's also, of course, clearly a very progressive, democratic city, which goes to show that this is, you know, racial inequality is not a problem with conservatives or a particular region of the country. And so now I wasn't a writer writing about education, having to choose a school for my daughter in a segregated system and having to decide whether I was going to use my privilege as a black person, but a middle class black person, and get my child into one of the few integrated schools in the city, or was I going to enroll her in one of the many segregated schools in the city that I write about?
I think you're really gracious on both sides that you're never going to say it's an easy choice.
It is not.
Even though there's this moral, ethical element to it, it doesn't make it easy. And I think that you and you and your husband even had some disagreements about
this. Yes. So my husband was a military brat. And that meant that he actually had a very unusual experience for a black child in America, in that because he went to schools on the base, base schools are integrated, and he never experienced school segregation. I started my education in segregated schools, and starting in the second grade, I was bused to white schools as part of a desegregation program.
This was in Iowa?
In Iowa. Very white state as well. Which is why I'm never surprised when I see black people in a place like this. I'm like, we're everywhere. It might not be a lot of us, but...
Even here.
I think
your tweet today
be.
About Salt Lake said, of all places,
yes,
right? I'm in
yes.
Salt Lake City tonight, of all places. Well, we're glad you're here.
Thank you. Feels very familiar. So both of us actually had integrated school experiences, which I think were very transformative for us. I was able to get out of a very high poverty, segregated school that didn't have the best instruction, and I was able to get access to the best public schools in my town. And my husband was also able to have integrated education. So when it came to my daughter, I kind of sprung it on my husband that I intended to enroll her in one of the segregated high poverty schools in our city, because while I understand that segregation is structural, I also know that every time an individual parent chooses to avoid these schools, we are also then condoning that system, and we are upholding that system.
But also,
my husband did not feel the same way.
Yeah.
And part of what the article gets into, which of course, so we had many arguments about this, and as we're having the arguments, neither one of us knew that one day this was going to appear in the New York Times. But I felt that was an important, and I think the reason that story had such an impact was because it was so personal, that here I was, someone who was writing about this inequality, but also as a parent able to understand how difficult these choices are, particularly in a city where schools are so unequal. I mean, this is the problem with segregation, is the difference in education that some children are receiving versus others is so vast that to ask a parent who has a choice to choose to put their child in the school that's having such an inferior education is a very hard ask. But at the same time, as I said in the article, I don't believe my child deserves more than other kids. And how do we sustain those schools for anyone's kids if they're not good enough for our own children? So in the end, because you know I always win in my household, kind of kidding. My husband was like, I saw you say that in one of your talks, and I really didn't appreciate that. So,
well, he's not here tonight.
He's
right?
Not here tonight. But I think this is being streamed, which is usually how he like
right.
gets me.
Right, he does his homework.
But actually, I asked him to, because what happens is, and most of you probably know this, you know, you go online, you look up a school, the first thing or one of the first things you look at are the test scores, and the second thing people look at are the demographics. And they think that the demographics of that school tells them everything that they need to know. Mm-hmm. Test scores largely reflect the population of the schools. They don't necessarily reflect the instruction. They don't reflect whether the kids are smart or not. They reflect the lack of opportunity that most of the kids have come from. And so my husband also looked at the test scores, and one of the things that I hoped my work would do is to get parents to actually go in the schools. Don't just write the schools off because you see a high black or Latino population, you see low test scores, and you assume that these are not good schools. And once I got my husband to go into the schools, he realized really how immoral it is. And I think that's been the change in my work from going from just being like a straight, I'm just reporting the facts, to actually like centering the immorality of segregation in my work. That it's immoral to say, this school's not good enough for my kid, but it's fine for all these other parents'
right.
kids, right? It is immoral.
Yeah.
But it's also unnatural, right, as a parent, to not try to get every advantage for your own child.
Well, you also said something interesting in the article, which is there's a huge benefit for someone like you and your husband to be a part of a school, right? Like you, a really committed pair of parents is a pillar for a school. As a teacher, I really noticed that. When I had parents I could rely on, parents that gave me feedback, parents that showed up, that gave you strength and energy. Sometimes parents showed up a little too much, but for the most part, and I feel like, and so yes, it is a moral question, but also you knew what you were getting yourself into in some ways, and you knew that you could influence the future of that school.
Absolutely, and I would say, so one, my child has so many advantages, and I think the thing that disturbs me the most is parents who can give their child every single advantage are like, I'm gonna take this one too. In a public system, right? Like, we're in a capitalist country, so if you can pay for a private school, then use your money to buy whatever the best education you can. But if you truly believe in public education, then you have to believe in the true notion of public education, which originally were called common schools, which means every child will walk in the door of that school, no matter who they are, and get the same education. Not that the richest, most advantaged kids will get the best public education, and the poorest, most disadvantaged kids will get the worst public education. We should all be getting the same. That's what public schools are supposed to be. And so I think for me, what was most important is understanding that if you already have every advantage, can you not give up a little bit of one for the common good when it comes to this? Like my daughter, I knew that even though segregated schools do not offer the same educational opportunity, that my child would be fine, because anything she didn't get in that school, I can give her anything. And she's actually doing great academically because, of course, like I can give her everything. What more important than how involved certain parents are is the clout and the power that we bring into a school. When I'm in that school, certain things just will never happen. We were having a problem in the cafeteria. Some of the parents who lived in the housing projects had been complaining about the cafeteria. I'm never in the school because I travel a lot. Mm-hmm. And you know this, poor parents who aren't in the school, we say they don't care about their kids' education. No one ever accuses me of not caring about my kids' education. I'm never in the school. It's because I'm a middle-class educated parent. So the assumption is that I care.
Right.
The assumption is that poor parents don't. They're working hourly jobs, which makes it much more difficult for them to be in school. So these parents were complaining about the cafeteria, and no one cared. I come in because my daughter tells me cafeteria's a little crazy. I come in, I observe it, I meet with the principal. Next day it's fixed, because I'm a reporter at the New York Times and I matter.
That's right? I'm wondering if we could just have one investigative reporter with right? kids at every school in America.
But it is, you know, and that's the uncomfortable thing, is it is the power that certain parents, I mean, you were a teacher, mm-hmm. I covered education for a long time. If anyone believes that black parents don't care about their kids' education, you've never been around black parents. Black parents desperately understand that education is often the only thing they can give their kids. And I was an education reporter, and I would sit in these meetings, school board meetings, where poor black parents would come week after week and complain about things in their school, and no one listened to them. And a rich white parent could come in and complain about one little thing, and it would be fixed. And that's what I talk about, that integration is so important, because it requires a sharing of power. You can't isolate those students. You can't not give those students textbooks. You can't not give those students good teachers if there's white kids in that school, because those white parents are going to get those things for their kids. Right. And I think that was the most important thing about my husband and I going into this segregated school, was not that we were just great parents who cared. All the parents cared. As I understood that we were parents that could make sure that that school got what it needed, because you best believe the administrators cared about what we thought.
Right.
Which is, I want to say it's f***ed up because I cuss a lot, but, right, like, that's completely f***ed up.
Right. But also, I like how you are willing to, I mean.
Oh, this is like.
Now I'm going to try some.
Religious state, huh?
You're among NPR listeners in a religious state, so.
Okay, cool.
Just take that in mind. I'm just really quick going to try some, to play a clip here. Hopefully this works. Because we talked about your situation, your family, you threw yourself into the spotlight. I know you kind of regretted a little bit that article during that process. I'm very grateful you were willing to publish that. I know that wasn't easy.
No, and that, yeah. It wasn't.
It wasn't. It couldn't have been. It's very personal, and I really, really appreciate you doing that. And I know that anyone who's read it feels the same way. With the This American Life story, it's Michael Brown's family. It's his community in Missouri. And I want to play this clip because I think it shows kind of what kids are up against, and also I think shows your unique voice as a reporter. I'm going to try to get some context, and you correct me if I'm wrong here. But Michael Brown's district, Normandy, was in a very bad state, primarily black, very underachieving schools, all black, underachieving schools. They lost their accreditation. And the state of Missouri gave some of these kids the options, or at least some of the families the options, to bus into Francis Howe, a district nearby.
It was an accident, but yeah.
It was an accident?
Yeah. Michael Brown's district was the worst district in the state of Missouri. 517 school districts in the state, it was 517. It's an accreditation document. I don't remember the exact number, but I think it might have got 15 points out of 100. It was terrible. No district had ever really lost its full accreditation, and the state superintendent finally stripped the accreditation, and it triggered this little-known law, the Missouri Transfer Law, which said if a district is unaccredited, those students have a right to go to an accredited school nearby that the district has to pay for. But no one actually knew that.
Right, right. So
that was going to happen. So they didn't actually intend for those kids to be able to go get a good education, but it accidentally worked out that way.
Right. And I should say, just for context, Michael Brown was killed. There's been so many things happen should never assume somebody remembers a story, but
right.
Michael Brown was killed, and his mother...
Right after he graduated,
and his mother, in a news clip, said, I got him through school. We got him through school. You know how hard it is.
Right. She was like, do you know how hard it is to get... So as her son is laying behind her, dead on the ground, behind police tape, she's talking about how hard it was to get a black boy to graduate.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, all of your parents... And most of us who haven't had to struggle to get our kids through a quality school would not be thinking about school at that point.
Right.
So that's what initially brought me to do the story.
So when it became public knowledge that some of these students were going to be bused into this primarily white district,
yes,
there was a town hall meeting or this public forum, and you play some of the parents, you play some clips of the parents speaking very angrily about the idea of some of these Normandy students, these black students coming to their schools. I want to play just a small portion. You're going to hear one of the parents' voices. She's particularly angry. And then we're going to hear a little bit of your writing. Hopefully this works here.
In 1 month, I send my 3 small children to...
Yeah, let me start over. So this is public forum. This is a parent who just got up to the mic and is talking about why they don't want these students bussed into her children's district.
Now, mind you, just set this a little bit more. These are parents whose school district is failing, who are wanting to bus their children 30 miles just to get a quality education. So these are not folks who don't care about their kids' education.
Right, right.
In 1 month, I send my 3 small children to you, and I want to know, is there going to be metal detectors? Because I want to be clear. I'm no expert. I'm not you guys. I don't have an accreditation, but I've read. I've read. So we're not talking about the Normandy School District losing their accreditation because of their buildings or their structures or their teachers. We are talking about violent behavior that is coming in with my first grader, my third grader, and my middle schooler that I'm very worried about. And I want to know, you have no choice like me, I want to know where the metal detectors are going to be. And I want to know where your drug-sniffing dogs are going to be. And I want, this is what I want. I want the same security that Normandy gets when they walk through their school door. And I want it here. And I want that security before my children walk into Francis Howe. Because I shopped for a school district. I deserve to not have to worry about my children getting stabbed or taking a drug, or getting robbed, because that's the issue.
To be clear, Normandy did not lose its accreditation because of violence. It's easy to judge these parents, but I think part of what makes this scene so startling is that we rarely fight these battles anymore. The reaction to large numbers of black children moving into white schools would probably sound no different in New York or Chicago or Boston. It's just that in most of the country, no one is even trying. These parents don't want to try either.
That's some good radio writing. That's good radio writing right there. Two things I love about that. One is that she was worried about her kids taking a drug, just one.
Wait, her elementary school children, by the way.
I don't know what drug that is, but that one drug. But she was basically saying that these kids are coming here because they're like leaving a war zone, basically, right? And they're going to bring that war zone with them. But I was struck by, and you've already kind of mentioned this tonight, your first thing you're writing out of that offensive, offensive string of basically accusations is you say it's easy to judge these parents. And I think you're careful when you're writing to not villainize them, to not turn them into monsters. That's probably the easy thing, right? The easy thing is to hear this raucous town hall with people that seem like they are just blatantly being racist and to say, those are monsters, I'm not like them at all. What's the danger in that? What's the danger in turning those people into monsters in our heads?
So a couple of things. When I was writing that, my daughter's school was going through its own integration battle in Brooklyn, which of course, you know, has a reputation of being this bastion of liberal hipsters who like artisanal pickles and all of that.
Utopia.
Yeah. But it was those same parents who I was sitting in meetings that sounded eerily similar to that.
Like as in you were making these trips to Missouri and then coming back to Brooklyn and you were...
As a parent. So at that point, I wasn't planning on writing anything about it. I was going because these were meetings about a white school where half some of the parents were, kids were being rezoned to my daughter's school. So I was going to the meetings as a parent. And so I was thinking about that as I'm hearing this and I'm like, I know people are going to hear this and they're going to say, that's not me. Mm-hmm. Though Missouri is not a southern state, we kind of think of it as a southern state. It was a slave-holding state. It did have de jure segregation. It's certainly a red state. And I didn't want listeners to distance themselves because I knew that were this happening in their communities, these meetings would sound very much the same. But I also think, and this goes back to my feelings about Charlottesville, is if I portrayed them as monsters, that's easy to condemn.
Yep.
And no one has to actually look at what they're doing in their own lives and in their own communities that are upholding a system of inequality that looks identical to that but may not sound as visceral. So I was trying to pull the readers in and get them to reflect, or readers, I'm a writer, sorry, the listeners in and get them to reflect about how would they react in that circumstance? Could this happen in their own communities? Would they also, did they share those fears?
Yeah.
Which I know they do because, again, like what's so important is this mother, she's an elementary school student or a parent who's worried about her kids being stabbed by other first graders, which sounds ludicrous, except I heard those same things about my daughter's school, where the primary concern was being afraid that little kindergartners and pre-kindergartners were going to be violent to their children. So I just felt I was trying in that moment to get the listeners to reflect on themselves and not to other these parents because these racial fears and, you know, the language is very careful. No one ever mentions race, though race is clearly underlying everything that's being said there. I wanted people to be able to sit and reflect on themselves in that moment.
At one point, it's almost comical how far somebody goes to say those other kids, right?
Yes.
And they just don't want to say black kids.
They would, right, because you can't say that.
No, that'd be inappropriate.
That would be inappropriate.
I want to play one more clip from this story because I think it shows your one of your key strengths as a reporter, which is that you're just blunt. And you're blunt about things that other people
clearly
are not. And I was listening to this interview you did with was he the interim superintendent or was he the new superintendent of Normandy, the failing district?
He was the new one.
So he had this, I mean, not a great job coming his way, but he was energetic, he was excited. As I was listening to the interview, I kind of felt like it was a little reporter 101 class for me, because I also talk to similarly enthusiastic school administrators a lot. And even though the circumstance was dire in Normandy, there's a similar tone, right? There's this rah-rah-rah cheerleader. And, you know, the optimism, I think, has some power with it, but it also can be frustrating. when you want to have a compelling conversation, you're going to air on the radio. So I'm going to play this. This is your conversation with him, part of it.
So for whatever time we have...
Okay, I think this... So we're going to jump into some of his remarks, then we're going to hear you and kind of back and forth.
So for whatever time we have, they will get a quality education. They will get that because we know exactly what to do.
Can I just say, with all due respect, I've had this conversation with superintendents and principals in districts that look just like Normandy and schools that look just like Normandy for more than a decade. And you can look at districts and schools with the same racial makeup in every urban community across the country. And the same thing is said. We know what we need to do. But the schools do not turn around. Typically, an entire district does not turn around.
The entire district has never turned around. It has never happened. But that doesn't relieve us of the charge to attempt to do it. So you're right. It hasn't been done. However, our obligation to attempt to do it, it still remains. The kids are here. So you're right. It hasn't been done. But it's our watch.
So then, knowing that in these high poverty segregated districts, the students aren't doing well, is it possible for a black child in Missouri to get an equal education?
Wow, what a great question. The answer right now, I really don't know.
Yeah, that's a good interview, right? almost sincere in spite of himself in a moment there, right? And I think one thing is important here is I've worked with the schools. I'm sure that, you know, in your interactions with administrators and teachers, it's tough. By no means do I think that people are out there trying to harm kids in these schools. Hopefully, you know, I think the vast majority, I think people like him, I applaud them. I applaud their willingness. But there's this rhetoric that isn't very helpful. There's this speech that people slip into that doesn't really build much. Were you surprised by his response there towards the end?
No. So here's the thing, and I have a great deal of respect for administrators and teachers who go work in these districts because they are in an untenable situation. The inequality is structural. You have a district where nearly every child is in deep poverty, that is completely segregated, that gets none of the same resources. The tax base of the town is gone. It doesn't get funding, and he has been called in to fix it. He cannot fix that. The only people who can fix that is the state. And the only way to fix it would be to merge that segregated district with the other white districts around it and get those kids the same resources. And there's zero political will to do that. So I understand the position that he's in. He has to try to work within the system that exists. But what I have found in my career is we don't talk candidly about race. So if you ask the direct question, you usually get a great answer because people are not prepared for the question.
They don't have a prepared response.
They don't have a prepared response. I imagine no one had ever asked him if black kids in the state of Missouri could get a quality education. And he could not look me in the face, knowing what he knew, and say yes, because he wasn't prepared for the question. And this is actually the advice I give reporters who write about race all the time, is ask the most candid question about race that you know that person never asked, because we talk around it. Journalists, when it comes to race, are actually not really any better than your average American.
Yeah.
And so the same way that most of us talk around race every day, journalists do as well. And interestingly, I had also asked the state superintendent that same question, and she told me no. Like, her answer was no, they cannot,
Yeah. Which
went in the print piece. So think about the woman in charge of administering public education in the state of Missouri admitted on the record that black children were not getting an equal education, and nothing happened.
Right. Yeah. Well, the hope now, we're going to bring on some more panelists, and we're going to have a candid conversation about Utah. Utah's a little different than Missouri. Utah's a little different than New York, but even when things look different racially, I think some of these principles really translate well. So I'm going to ask our two panelists to come up here, and once you're sitting up here, I'm going to read these intros for you. We have Jessica Dwyer and Kathleen Christie. I'm going to wait for them to get up here. All right. So I'll start with you, Kathleen. I'll start with your bio here. Kathleen Christie is originally from Compton, California. She moved to Utah to attend the University of Utah and has lived in the state for most of her adult life. She's been an educator for 42 years, having served as a teacher, an equity specialist at the Utah State Office of Education, an elementary school principal, school director, assistant superintendent, and most recently as equity plan coordinator for the Salt Lake City School District. She's qualified to talk about these things. her administrative career has been focused on working on educational equity, which involves student advocacy, ASL, ESL, multicultural education, American Indian education, civil rights compliance, and addressing the achievement gap. There's more we could say. There's a lot you've accomplished. We're going to keep it there for now. Jessica Dwyer, who goes by Jess, right?
Yep.
Okay. Jess joined the University of Utah's Center for Science and Mathematics Education in 2016 after a decade-long career in secondary science education. As a teacher, Jessica achieved National Board Certification in 2014 and held level 3 endorsements in biological science, earth environmental science, English as a second language, and middle school science. So you had endorsements for all those subjects. Okay, so that's impressive. I had one endorsement, and that was enough for me. Before she worked in Title I middle and high schools in California, Colorado, and Utah. She worked as a park ranger in the Bay Area and in wilderness therapy in southern Utah. I should say where you went to school too here. Her undergraduate work was in biology at San Francisco State University, and she earned her master's degree at Stanford University, where she focused on secondary science instruction. So you're both very qualified to be up here tonight, and you're both very up to date with what's happening in Utah classrooms right now. So I guess and this might be really open-ended, but what does diversity look like? Let's start in Salt Lake. let's make it easy, okay? What does diversity look like in Salt Lake classrooms? I think statistically it's about 42% white in Salt Lake City, so unlike
in
the
schools?
In schools.
The district, yeah.
Across the district,
Salt Lake City.
Statewide, we're 75% white. So,
yes.
So Salt Lake City is a little anomaly.
It's an anomaly right
here
in the
maybe
city.
Kathleen, just tell me a little bit about what diversity looks like on the ground here in Salt Lake.
So with our student of color population being close to almost 70%, it's getting there, it's growing yearly, but 60, we'll say, start with 60. When you look at the city itself, our city is divided. We have basically a two-tier system. We have our East Bench, which are predominantly white, middle-class families, and then you have the West Side, which are low-income predominantly, where most of our students of color live. So even though in the aggregate we look like we are a majority minority school district, quote-unquote, but we are still pretty much segregated in terms of the way we're divided.
Right. And I'm wondering if when you got to Salt Lake School District, or maybe when you started teaching here, were people open to discussing that?
Before you go there, I'd like to touch on the word diversity in this context, because I think one of the really amazing things about Salt Lake is that it's really diverse. We have the biggest Tongan population outside of Tonga. We're one of 7 refugee resettlement cities. So most often you'll find anywhere, you know, a high school will have 142 languages spoken. And so I think you asked about the similarities and differences. I think in Nicole's work, she's working in communities that have been really segregated. And so when people use the word diversity to mean all people of color, you can have a community of color that's not diverse, right? And that's a different conversation than a truly diverse community with lots of overlapping heterogeneity across lots of measures. So I think each provides an interesting opportunity and interesting challenges, and the structures look the same, but the answers might be nuanced and different and need a lot more community input.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Community
different.
Input.
Different.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. And maybe, Kathleen, when we talked on the phone, you shared a little bit about how there's the struggle, but there's also some happy, I don't want to call them coincidences, but there's places where it works pretty well, or at least where you see a student body, I guess I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what does it look like when it works well, the idea of students from all over achieving together, achieving well.
Working well together.
Right.
So I gave an example of, and it all depends on the leadership and the and how the leader in the school has worked with the community and the faculty to create an environment where students feel that this is our school, we feel welcome, we feel that we're included, we see ourselves. So one particular example, a school that I've been working very closely with has been Jackson Elementary. They are a dual immersion school, and they've had parents who, they fought the system, they're still fighting the system in terms of getting in the door, getting their ideas recognized, but they started a program there at Jackson, and it was a collaboration between the school and the University of Utah to bring in professors and undergrad students to help the whole school to understand and develop a college-going culture. And this was one of the first of its type in our school district, and this was an example of how families who are in the school, in a low-income school, can make a difference in that school. And these families were, so happened to be college professors, but they lived in the neighborhood and they chose to make that school better because they wanted to improve the schooling for all of the kids in that neighborhood.
Right, yeah. And they were, I mean, I hate to use the word courage because, I mean, these are kids in that school.
Well, they, yeah.
Right, but there was some...
But it was hard, and they're still fighting the system to try to make change within the school. There's still that need to have to continue to push up against the system. Even though we have families, we have parents, we have concerned patrons who want to bring about change in some of our schools.
Right. Nicole, was there something you wanted to respond to? Okay. And, well, I just want to, it's kind of a tangent here. It's interesting because Kathleen and I grew up about 20 minutes from each other. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Los Alamitos, California. You grew up in Compton.
Right.
They're very different places.
Very.
I went to a primarily white school. Compton is not primarily white.
No. It was all black when I was there.
And my school was diverse to a point. I think it was about 60% white. But it was a very comfortable school. It was easy to go to school there. It was easy to achieve there. That was the expectation. You were going to achieve a lot of things. You know, our valedictorian went to Harvard, and that was just an expectation. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, as a teenager, I never thought about race being a factor in that. I never thought about how, when I go over to Long Beach or I go near Compton or Lakewood, that race has a big determining factor in what you achieve. Coming from Compton High. What was it that, I mean, how did you end up at University of Utah? How'd you end up doing that?
Okay, that was a good question. Okay, so right out of high school, my ex-husband played football. He got a scholarship to the University of Utah. I didn't even know where Utah was on the map. Salt Lake City, I'd heard of that because I'd heard about the lake. So we get here and I mean, it was culture shock for me coming from an all-black community. And by the way, when I grew up in Compton, with it being all black, it was not the way it's depicted today and the way the struggles that are in most cities of that type, where you have lots of low income, struggling folks who are trying to make it. It was a little different. It was a small bedroom community back then. But coming here to the University of Utah, it was all white. And I had not been in a setting where there were all white people like this. So it took me a while to really understand where I fit in as a black student at the University of Utah, not having had a whole lot of consciousness around my identity. And that's where my journey has been, and I think a lot of our students have to deal with that whole development of their identity. Mm-hmm. Which is where school, it can happen in schools, but if we don't intentionally do that work with our students, then it doesn't happen, and you know, kids will learn somewhere else, outside of school or later in life.
Right. I want to come back to that intentional aspect. Jess, a lot of what your work is now is you're thinking about teachers going out to these schools, right?
Yeah.
Just tell me about, we've talked a lot about student diversity, student populations, teacher diversity obviously is a big part of this that needs to be talked about. What are the struggles in getting more diverse teachers? Even that word diverse again, right? Mm-hmm. So you can kind of unpack that, but how do you get more diverse teacher workforce out there? Is it harder than expected, is it?
I think there's, so we can look at that question in a couple ways. One is to acknowledge that, my mic sounds terrible. Is there something that should be, are we good? Teacher move. We can't wait until our teachers reflect the demographics of our students to take on the charge of acknowledging social injustice in the classroom. So today, we train in inclusive pedagogy and equity and access, and there are a lot of things that teachers can do right now to make sure that every kid gets a shot in their classes. So we start there. And then we can imagine that if we do that very well, then school might feel like a good place to be. I know that I chose to be a teacher because I understood what it was, and I felt comfortable in school. Why on earth would someone choose to be a teacher if they never had that experience? Mm-hmm. So we have to start there. Then we really need to look at the way, I really struggle with this. I struggle with young people deciding what they're going to do with their lives and knowing that we don't pay teachers living wages. And if I'm truly working from a social justice angle, and I'm trying to help communities struggling with intergenerational poverty, why would I invite a STEM graduate into a profession where they're not going to be able to buy a home? So it's...
Because, I mean, there are some teachers, white teachers, who can't have fallback, right? They might not be making very much money, but their parents can support them a little bit. They have the benefits, right, where they can be lifted up a little bit. And you have these students who are looking at, this is going to be their sole source of income forever, right? I think it's a really important fact. I never thought of it in those terms directly. But especially if you're STEM certified, you have a brain that can do a lot of different jobs, right? And you're asking them to...
And out the gate, you can get paid 4 to 6 times what a teacher gets paid.
Right. But some are willing. I mean, it's hard to ask of it. I mean, ask that of them. But are you noticing here in Utah that there are? You're surprised by who's interested, or who are you seeing come go?
Often, when I speak to especially undergrads of color who are considering their career options, they're supporting their families. The income is the number one concern.
Mm-hmm. Or they've been veered away from education because
right,
we want.
That's our, if I get to talk to them,
exactly,
right? If they make it to me, right?
Yeah.
And I want to come back to intentional comment, right? There's intentional things you can do. In a Utah school, you know, here in Salt Lake, since that's the obvious example, since that's where we are right now, what are some things you can intentionally do that are a little unnatural here? I mean, it's because, like you said, race isn't as frequently a topic here. What are some intentional things you did, Kathleen, in your work here to make it a factor, to bring it into somebody's mind and start responding to it?
Saying, at least say the word. But when I first started trying to have this dialogue about why, helping our staff to understand why are we the way, where we are now in terms of our achievement gap or our low performance for a lot of our students, why are we asking that question? And then when we started disaggregating our data and started to see the patterns, we still couldn't say, well, it looks like there's a predictability here with based on race. And when we finally got to that place where we could say, okay, it looks like, based on the data, that our students who are of different races are, especially non-white, are not performing as well as our white, and mainly our white students. We did have some Asian students in that category as well. But people couldn't say the word race. It was based on race. It was based on how they're treated based on their race, or how they experience school based on their race. And so that was how I try to have these conversations, start the dialogue, to help us understand, to get to the root cause, because we couldn't address it until we acknowledge that it exists in our district. And it's still a challenge. People are still unwilling to take it and say, okay, this is what it is, now what do we do? Small pockets in some schools, courageous leaders have taken it on, but it's still a major issue.
Yeah, and I mean, I see it myself. Like you said, reporters are often worried about talking about race. They'll avoid it. I mean, I'll go to a predominantly Hispanic school in West Valley here, and off mic, I'll acknowledge race. I'll turn the mic on, and then we have a different conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's almost out of a service to this administrator. You know, God forbid they have to acknowledge the fact that they have a predominantly Hispanic community. But just that first step. I'm wondering, Jess, is that part of when you're talking about the teachers need to be ready now, we can't wait for them to be more diverse, to be more equipped. Is part of it just getting them kind of in that place to acknowledge it, to be very open and candid about what kind of schools they're interested in teaching at and what they might be seeing in the classroom?
I don't know. I'm actually really conflicted in my own personal practice about thinking about that right now. Because of my own experience, I used to think that as a white woman, I had to do the sort of personal reflective acknowledgement of privilege and positionality in order to be effective. And so therefore, I thought that all white educators, especially those teaching in communities of color, but really all white educators, would need to go through that process similarly. That process can be facilitated well or can be facilitated to invite guilt and shame in a way that prevents action and sort of solidifies non-useful identities. So now I think that maybe we can, through best practices, through being ferocious about policing policy, through doing the really subtle data illumination that Kathleen has referenced, I do think we can get people to start working towards equity without naming it, but I don't think that's enough. And
well, it's interesting that idea that to acknowledge race as a white person, you have to have that guilt and shame buffer. And I think that it almost just takes bravery to kind of, let's get past that and let's get constructive about it.
I don't think you have to have that. And right. I think that's been the fault of the training of the last 20 years. It's actually a really easy place to go. Because if I feel guilt and shame, then that's all I have to do. If I acknowledge my privilege, acknowledge that my success is not all mine, that I've benefited significantly from a racist culture, that I'm racist, that there's no way I can't be racist because my brain was shaped by a racist culture, then as soon as I can own that and start moving forward with that, if I'm acting against it, I have no cause for guilt or shame. I can be really transparent about that. I can ask for help and I can offer the resources that I have to offer. But I think this sort of like, ooh, we're going to talk about race, it's going to be hard, doesn't actually move the conversation along. I think we can just say...
I think that was a direct quote from me at the beginning of this, by the way.
I think it was. You're welcome. I don't know that... I think that our history is hard, but I think if we prioritize relationships and prioritize learning about each other, I don't think the work always has to feel terribly uncomfortable.
So, I think it's important to acknowledge that we have, on my Twitter bio, say I write about race from 1619. 1619 is the year that the first Africans were brought to these shores to be enslaved. We land in Jamestown, the English land in Jamestown, 1604. So 15 years after the English land here, we have already imported Africans to be enslaved and determined that we will be a country run on racial caste before we're even a country. I say that to say that racism, racial inequality is embedded in the DNA of our country. Now, we don't have to feel guilt about that, but we have to acknowledge that that is the fundamental fact. This is not fake news. This is just the fact, right? If you can acknowledge that, then you can understand that I don't have to take personal responsibility for our past, but I need to acknowledge that the past is shaping how things are today, and I can either choose to let that remain the same or I can work to disrupt it. Since the end of the Civil War, so from 1619 until 1968, we had explicitly racial laws, racist laws. Everything in this country was explicitly governed by race. And as soon as those laws were struck down, we immediately decided we are going to be a colorblind country. And that white people cannot acknowledge that race exists. We have to pretend we don't see race. We have to pretend that when you look at me, you somehow can't tell that I'm black. And so that's how we have our conversations, is I need to deny that race has any influence on anything and that I can see race at all. The problem is that race still shapes everything. And so when I think about, and I have no training in this whatsoever, just as a reporter and someone who studies race, is we know that white educators have lower expectations of black children. We know that they are much more likely to harshly discipline black children. So you have to acknowledge that this exists in order to be able to deal with why do you have these expectations. Right. It doesn't mean you're a bad person. It means you were raised in America, and America has taught you that black children are inferior. But because we need to have this colorblind view, we cannot acknowledge these things. And if you can't acknowledge that you are not, in fact, colorblind, that before you were ever born, the concepts of who black people are were already shaped and embedded, then how can you then do something differently? And so I think probably the most depressing thing that came out of the election of President Obama was that we were post-racial. We never need to talk about or acknowledge race again. And I think we're clearly at a point now, at least I hope, where we can see that race still fundamentally drives so much in this country. And you don't have to take on the guilt of our history, but you have to acknowledge our history. And then you either decide whether you're going to continue to uphold those practices or you're going to do something different. And I'm looking at this audience, and when I find myself giving these talks in like these extremely white cities, I know I tell a lot of jokes, so I'm not actually being funny right now. I wonder like, what will y'all take away from this, right? Will you leave this and feel like this has nothing to do with me? I don't know how I can do anything about this. And so it's fascinating that in what is one of the whitest cities in the country, that you have a school, public school system that is minority white. Mm-hmm. And what that tells me is that even a very white place, the same problems with race that you see in every other place are replicated here. Yes. And why are so many white people withdrawing from the public system here when it should be a majority white school system? Mm-hmm. And then that tells me that you can leave this talk and actually do something to change that. Right. But this isn't a place where there aren't enough people of color that you can change. And you're not even asking a question, but I'm just going to say this last thing, and then I'll let you take back over your moderator. And I also look at, and I think, so I'm making a moral argument, but I also know most of us actually don't just do things because it's morally the right thing to do. We have a country now where half of all children being born are not white.
That's right.
So it was one thing we were not going to educate 15% of the population of our country. But when you're not going to educate half of the children in this country, who's going to pay your Social Security one day? Who's going to pay the taxes that fund the infrastructure in this country? Who are going to fill the jobs that need to be filled? So if the morality of the fact that we are depriving American children of the promises that we've made them because their skin is different, that doesn't bother you. It should bother you that you're no longer going to be able to contain that inequality just to them, that as Malcolm X said, the chickens will come home to roost. And it's going to affect everyone here to have such a large segment of our population that is uneducated and unable to take part in the bounty of our country. Mm-hmm. That's the end of my soapbox for now. Sorry.
And that's particularly here. Yes. In Utah, because Salt Lake City is an anomaly with and Ogden, but statewide, it really doesn't look too bad. When you look at our demographics and you look at our performance, the student achievement statewide, we still come up pretty close to the top in comparison to the other states. But then you narrow down to the districts, you look at Salt Lake, you look at Ogden, here you have these majority districts where students are not performing, they're not proficient, and we are not educating them. So there's where we've got to then just keep pushing this dialogue about what are we gonna do? It's gotta be intentional. We just can't keep doing the same thing.
Well, and I'm wondering what you think, Nicole. We have a lot of pause breaks. It's good. I'm wondering what you think.
Let's just know they're awake.
Exactly. What Jess was saying about somebody giving themselves credit for something that isn't actually very productive. I mean, do you see that a lot, where it's like, you know, kind of like that shame and the guilt, where somebody will give themselves credit for having a racial experience or, you know, a moment where they acknowledge race, but they're still not actually doing anything. And I think that kind of what you're saying about, well, you have this community here, you can do something. Do you see a lot of people kind of spinning their wheels, thinking that they're having an experience with acknowledging race, but really they're just, it's just internal, and they're not willing to put it into action? I'm wondering if that's something you run into a lot.
Yeah, I mean, again, and I live in probably one of the most progressive cities in the world that sustains one of the most segregated and unequal school systems in the world. I give all kinds of talks to white audiences in New York, and everyone in that audience agrees with me, and then everybody in that audience keeps their kid in a school away from most of the black and brown kids in New York City. And we all do that to some extent, right? I mean, I think it's very hard to actually, it's easy to have values in the abstract. It is hard to live those values in real life, especially when we have a system we didn't create that is very unequal. But what I'm saying is, then let's acknowledge that we're choosing that.
Yes.
That we are choosing to sustain the system, and we want to have clean hands, and we don't. And I think that's what I'm trying to do, is say, you can come talk to me, but I'm not going to make you feel good about coming here. This is not your penance. I do not absolve you all, which I think is what people are looking for. You come here, you feel uncomfortable for about an hour and a half, and then you can go home and be free of your burden. I'm saying that's not enough, and I think that was why it was so important for me to put my daughter in the type of schools I write about, because I can sit here and I cannot say I also understand I wouldn't do that to my child. But I can also sit here and say, my child is doing great. And this is the thing, I think, this is the big secret. Those kids are just as good as our kids. Mm-hmm. And those kids have just as much to offer, and even more, because they're more resilient, they're more generous, they understand what it's like not to have, and I think that that is so important. And I also sit here as like a personal testimony, because I believe I'm here because somebody let me out of my bad opportunity into a good opportunity. It's not that I'm better than all the other kids who didn't make it. It's that I got out, mm-hmm. and I got to go to a good school, mm-hmm. and I got to have my mind broadened because I was around all types of different kids. Mm-hmm. Everybody in my neighborhood's parents worked at factories. I got to go to school with kids whose parents were doctors and lawyers, so I could start to think about myself in a different way. And not bragging, I've done better than everyone in my high school class. You know, so I'm like, you were worried about the poor black kid, but the poor black kid was actually like smarter than most of y'all and did better than most of y'all. So you think about all of the kids like me who are stuck in these schools, who will never be able to live the life that I've lived, not because their parents didn't care, not because they weren't smart, not because they didn't want it, but just because they didn't have opportunity. And those are the kids who I'm speaking for. And whether, like, you know, some people in the audience feel a little uncomfortable, I actually don't really care. Because you guys have power and they don't.
Yes.
And I know you see those kids, and I know you see those kids. And I'm also fighting for just the average C student who's not that great in school, but still deserves a quality education either way. I just think, I just wish that we would take this energy and actually do something with it and change the experiences of these kids.
I think a big part of that, a lot of times in these conversations, we talk about what rich white people will need to give up. Uh-huh. And that's true. Richard Reeves wrote the book, it was just on Radio West, Dream Hoarders. I encourage you to check it out. It's not the 1%, right? It's the liberal aristocracy. We're doing it. Mm-hmm. We're keeping stuff the way it is. And I think a lot of the time when we have these conversations, we focus on what those folks, us folks, will need to give up in order to make things right. And it's easy for me to quantify the fact that my grandmother owned a house which, in combination with the GI Bill, enabled my parents to own a house, which meant that I didn't need to use my social security number to help them get a loan, which meant I had a reasonable credit score, so even as a teacher, I could buy a house. I can quantify my history of privilege, right? But what I can't do is quantify what I've lost by hanging out with people who look and think like me for my entire life. That was expensive for me. And it was expensive for my community, and it's expensive as we scale out for our country. And we know that when we die, it doesn't matter what square footage. It matters what relationships we had. It matters how many times I asked, tell me what it's like not to be me, and I listened to the answer. My brain could have been shaped different. I could have come up with something different and better if I had been pushed by someone who was more ready to challenge me. And I was denied that experience because of the way that we structure our culture. So yeah, it's important to focus on what white folks will need to give up, but it's also important to focus on what we're missing, which is significant.
Mm-hmm. And that, yeah. So the way I see us moving forward and taking action in Utah is that we've got to work hard to create our strong neighborhood schools. The way we've tried to desegregate our schools is busing some of our low-income kids to our east side schools or more affluent schools to integrate those schools, right, to create diversity there. And who suffers are the low-income kids. Those are the ones who are on the bus back and forth every day. So we have got to be, again, intentional about strengthening and developing strong neighborhood schools, listening to the voices of parents and families and patrons who live in the community who want to help. But I think that's a weakness we have in our system, is that we're not ready for that. Many of our classroom teachers and schools don't have open doors for people to come in and partner and help and join in the dialogue conversation. What can we do here? Mm. That has to happen in our schools.
I want to understand, like, it's going to be messy.
It's going to be messy.
I think the thing is, like, we want it to be easy. We want, like, everybody to come together. We sing kumbaya.
Right.
It doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. We have a long history. Right. There's a lot of inequality. Mm-hmm. There are cultural differences. There are power differences.
Right.
I mean, I think one of the things that, as my daughter's school, as we're concerned about a gentrifying, we're worried about the black and brown parents who have managed somehow to get a good quality education in a segregated setting lose power in their school. So I think what my work tries to show is it literally took centuries to create the system we have now. Mm-hmm. And it took lots of effort from the federal government, the state government, the local government, and private citizens to create what we have. The only way that you undo it is with an equal amount of effort.
Right.
And we've been willing to apply this much effort. And somehow are perplexed that we haven't fixed it. So I think the easiest things that you can do is enforce your fair housing law. Don't fight when affordable housing is coming in your neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And if you have school children, enroll your kids in your neighborhood school. Mm-hmm. So funny, like in New York City, where we have a lot of segregation.
Mm-hmm.
White parents want neighborhood schools if their neighborhood school is white.
That's right.
Their neighborhood school isn't white, they want universal choice, and
right,
they bus their kids
right
all over the city to go where they want to go. If you just went to the I imagine a city like this, if a lot of parents just went to their neighborhood schools, you would have actually a great deal mm-hmm of integration.
Mm-hmm.
That would be harder in New York,
mm-hmm,
which is what you were saying, is every community is a little bit different. But I think we just fundamentally have to acknowledge that you cannot have equality and also advantage for yourself
right
and your own children. And I get that that's hard, right? Like when I say I don't care if my child goes to Harvard, I sometimes hear like an audible gasp because we have been conditioned that school now is about competition,
yes,
and that you're not a good parent if you're not trying to like get your child into Ivy. And I'm like, I don't care. And I actually really don't care. Like, that's not going to make my daughter a good person.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to make her a person who cares about justice. Mm-hmm. Might not even make her a lot of money. I'm still paying my student loans, and I'm 41. Right? So it's like, what do you actually value? And what are you willing to, like, put in the game? What spit are you willing to put in the game for what you actually value? And if you're willing to put in nothing, stop saying you value it, I guess, is what I'll ask.
I can sense some people kind of almost jumping out of their seats with questions, I think, and this is a great time for that. We have two mics here. You can kind of form a line. And I think, I mean, there was kind of a challenge from Nicole about that this shouldn't be a passive experience tonight. It wouldn't make sense to come listen to a conversation about race if you were just going to congratulate yourself for what you're doing already. So those of you who have questions for our panelists, questions about your individual role or just bigger picture stuff, please come up to these two different mics and we'll kind of form two lines here. And please tell us your name and a little, maybe just a little bit about yourself.
Don't be afraid. We're nice.
My name is Beverly Cooper, and I want to say I've been a disruptor on women's issues most of my life, and I would love to be a disruptor on racism, and I'm aware of my privilege, and I've heard examples of how you've used your privilege to do that, and I need something concrete. I don't have kids in the school system, but I have a lot of time. And so give me something. I came tonight to hear something I could do.
You want to take it?
You want to?
Okay.
Thank you. Because we need more courageous people like you who are willing to help us to disrupt the system of racism. My suggestion would be to get involved in a local council, community council, if possible. At the school district, I know at Salt Lake District, there may be several options for committees. Jenny, I'm looking at you, where we need people who are willing to work in the community and help us to do this work. But so talk to either Jenny or me afterwards. We'd love to have you there. We need bodies. Mm-hmm. Willing bodies.
Did you want to add to that, Jess?
I think a great place to start with school segregation, like Nicole mentioned, is to head into a school. Invite yourself and see. I think we're a lot more active when we're excited about our actions. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to feel motivated and engaged. So I'd encourage you to go check out your local neighborhood school and see where you might be able to contribute there in a way that feels good to you.
Yeah, and I can't speak specifically to Salt Lake City, but I can tell you in New York, a group of parents, a racially mixed group of parents who felt very seriously about this have started a group, and they are strategizing around how to push the system to come up with a real integration plan. They meet regularly. They are very serious about it. They're trying to grow the group, so they are not satisfied that the school leadership is going to do something about it. They're coming together, and you don't have to be parents to push for that. Anyone who is interested in this can try to pull together a group to push the district to do what it should do, and the community, because a lot of it is trying to move the community to actually think that this is something that they should do.
Okay. And that can happen in Salt Lake.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a place where it can. It's not so entrenched here. The problem is not unsolvable as it feels in a lot of East Coast and Midwestern cities. This is a place where you actually could see substantial change if you worked on it.
My name is Julia Lyon. I'm a parent, and I have just entering the public school system. I have a first grader at Wasatch Elementary right now. And this is really a question for Kathleen and Jess. As you said, and I know you're right, that the schools in Salt Lake are pretty segregated, but it's high school where things totally combine. My understanding is they're majority-minority in the three high schools here. And I'm curious what you guys think about whether integration is successful there or not.
No.
Mm-mm. You said it first. They are tracked. They are not successful because we just allow things to happen the way they've always happened. So because of that tracking, because classes are AP classes are designed for certain kids, and so the classrooms are all white. You look at special ed, or you look at some of our lower, they don't call it, we made them change the title of the classes, didn't do anything, but the classes are still staffed or consist of students who are either low income or students of color, that are the lower track general ed type classes. Still the same within the school.
So what can they do about it?
D-track?
D-track, yeah. There are things to do, but it's going to take pressure. It's going to take constant pressure from outside to change things. I know within the school, some of our teachers, administrators try to. They want to, but there's too much pressure on the other side to keep it the same. So we've got to find ways to disrupt that, to you know, bring about voices that say, this is not right, and let's continue to push that.
I think Nicole's point earlier about wanting her daughter to be a good person, I hear that from parents a lot, that that's actually their primary goal. And then I watch parents coming to schools and advocate for what they think good parents should advocate for. They want their kids in the most advanced math class. They want their kids in four AP classes. And often that decision might not get run through the filter of, is this going to make my kiddo a better person? And it's part of that narrative about how we get ahead or stay ahead. And whenever we make a choice like that, it's always at the expense of something else. So how much are we insisting that we have these super high-level options that are going to serve a really small group of students at the expense of all the other students? We also know that when we do combine and have heterogeneous classes, study after study after study shows that it's better for everyone. That is not an expensive decision for those kids who are ready to rock and who are ready to really soar. And so it's when we make that choice in a tracking system, there's a consequence. When we make that choice in a truly integrated, supported system, it's better for everybody.
Yeah, I think the one thing we probably haven't said is all the data shows desegregation integration does not harm white children. It doesn't harm their test scores, it doesn't harm how well they do when they go to college, and it doesn't harm them emotionally or socially. So it has vast increases in test scores and achievement for black and brown students, and it doesn't hurt white children at all, and it actually helps them. But I don't think we talk about that enough. And the other point I would make to that is these schools are tracked because that's what white parents want. Right. The school system is responding to white parents who will only enroll their children in an integrated setting if their kids are separated in the highest level classes. What we know is all children would benefit from those, right? AP teachers are the best teachers. They're usually the strongest teachers. They've gotten the most training. And these are things, talented and gifted in upper level courses, that all children benefit from, but it is that opportunity hoarding and is that desire, even in an integrated building, to have segregated classrooms. So if white parents said to the district that they wanted to end tracking, tracking would end.
Mm-hmm. Let's go over here to this mic here.
There are many ways I think we can all contribute to the health of these children and to make them feel good about themselves and have an understanding of the role that their forebears played in this nation and in its development. Slavery is not talked about, but it should be, because it was the engine that created the, the American economy.
Absolutely.
And pushed it into the Industrial Revolution, where the wealth of this nation was made.
Absolutely.
It was based upon the forced labor of their very ancestors, and they can be proud of that. The Battle of Yorktown was decided by the taking out of barriers to the fort, which forced General Cornwallis to surrender to George Washington. The soldiers who won that battle We're from Rhode Island. 25% were white and Indian background, and the West were black. You know, the very independence of this country. If the North did not have, or the Patriots did not have the black Tories to be concerned about, there'd be no United States of America. Because with the advantage that the British had, they'd have taken it away. I was never taught that in school. I had to learn that from my own readings as I progressed in age. There's a lot that you can do to make a kid feel proud. And I was reading last week where, I can't think of the man's first name, but it's Dr. Weaver, who integrated, along with 17 other students, I don't know if it was in Missouri or what, but anyhow, when he got there, the teachers did everything to make him fail. And if it wasn't for his junior high school teachers, who tutored him, he would not have begun to achieve in school. He went on to Howard University, and he, it turns out that his junior high school teacher filled out his application and did the work for him because he didn't know where Howard University was. And now this man is he's the director of a hospital surgery section in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There are kids just waiting to be turned on to learning, you know, and...
Maybe a good question for our panelists is, how does our conversations about history in the classroom, how does our conversation about race in the classroom when it's actually a subject you're teaching, right?
It's relevant, man.
What was that?
We're just talking about it's relevant.
Okay. I wanted to get back to the panel because we have a lot of questions to get through. But I'm just wondering, what you're saying is that this conversation about how race is discussed in the classroom actually will impact somebody's achievement.
Everything. You make those children feel wanted, and you work as hard as they will, they'll surprise you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
In my study, my dissertation, I studied 12 teachers, and we had engaged in conversations about race, and they were so upset as we moved along because they hadn't learned a lot in school. Like, how come I didn't learn this in school? And had they known a lot of the history of our country, the racial history of our country, they felt they would have had, they know they would have better relationships with kids, or they would understand the whys of what's going on. So yeah, there's something to say about what we're taught in school, how we're taught it, and what's been left out.
Thinking about my school not being that far from Compton High,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the conversations we had with our teachers,
mm-hmm.
race wasn't really a big element of that. Or if it was definitely hindsight,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
I've been thinking about that this week, is why wasn't that on my mind more?
Right.
It should have been.
Well, and understanding, the history of race is the history of America.
Right.
This is not a distinct and separate area of study. It is foundational. Slavery is mentioned originally in the Declaration of Independence, and Thomas Jefferson has to take it out in order to get signers to the Declaration because they wanted to maintain slavery. Slavery is in the Constitution. Slavery is in every, if you look at the New Deal legislation is passed by excluding most jobs that black Americans had from Social Security. Like, there is almost nothing that it doesn't touch. And when you don't teach that, and then you want to try to get people to address racial inequality, people don't understand, white Americans don't understand, why are we still dealing with this? Why do we have to do these things? But also,
if white Americans are not understanding the contributions that black Americans have made to this country, then that also feeds into the notion that black Americans are an inferior culture, that they are not worthy because they have not contributed. And black kids, of course, I mean, when you say black kids don't care about school, it's not that, but they don't see a school and a curriculum that reflects anything that is relative to them. And I remember the first time I took a black studies class in high school, I was angry.
Yes.
Because I'm like, all these years when I felt that, learned that black folks never did anything but be owned by white people, and you mean there was all this history that someone could have taught me that gave me some self-esteem, that gave me some sense about myself and my history, and you chose not to do that? It was very upsetting. And I think it explains a lot of why race exists the way it does in this country now, is because we don't understand. The fact that in 2017 we're still arguing about whether the Civil War was fought about slavery is insane. But it's because we are literally not taught
That's right.
this history.
That's right.
Amen. You go over here.
So I wanted to ask your thoughts. My name is Ashley, and I'm a parent of a high school student, a middle schooler, and an elementary school student. And I'm on the east side, and so we take advantage of a lot of that privilege that has been discussed. But I wonder what your thoughts are on the institutions within the Salt Lake School District that shape the agendas and how they are often populated by white privileged individuals, even though, like you said, it's a majority minority district. So the Salt Lake School Board, I don't know that it has a member of color on it, even though we have 60% minority students. The SCC councils, the school community councils that each school has set up are often governed by exclusively white middle class parents. So when these are the groups that are shaping the policies, I mean, as much as I would love to have my high school student get to watch East High football games on a brand new field that cost $1 million, I would much rather see that money go to hire teachers and pay them a living wage. And I'm guessing that there weren't a lot of parents from the West Side in the room when those decisions on funding were made. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's very accurate. And it's unfortunate. I think that, again, as a district, as a community, we've got to be more open to diverse and different opinions. I think we have some work to do with encouraging our parents, our West Side parents, to have more of a voice. I mean, it's easier said than done.
Right. And
Is the school board elected at large?
I mean, that it's not subsidized, or there's no way to kind of help offset those costs, where it can be like a full-time job for these people.
Yeah.
It makes sense that people can't step in to run for those positions if the system isn't helping them to do that.
There's some work to be done there, but it can be done. And there are efforts to work with communities to encourage them to look to some of these positions.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Come over here. Yep.
I'm a teacher and a parent in the Salt Lake City School District, and I feel like I hear a lot of talk about diversity, about closing the achievement gap, but I want to thank Nicole Hannah-Jones for putting the term desegregation and segregation back on the radar. I don't think we hear a lot of discussion about that within the Salt Lake City School District and how to sort of shake and stir that up. And I think there are, while the panel has spoken a lot to like personal choices of like what to personally do, I think there are also institutional changes. But I'm interested in whether you have an opinion on the efficacy of terms as far as using the term desegregation as opposed to integration, which has some of these other meanings in education too, but it maybe feels a little bit more like a positive bent as opposed to a... So as we kind of nudge our school district towards actively addressing the segregation that we do have in the Salt Lake City School District, which terminology do you think is more effective or even legal? Because, like, as I understand, like, you're not allowed to, like, the Supreme Court recently said that you can't decide based on race in, like, choice programs or something. I don't know. So that's my question.
Okay, so I never use the word diversity. I hate the word. Diversity has no moral nor legal mandate. Diversity is just can be whatever. So I use either desegregation or integration, but they don't mean the same thing. Desegregation to me is what I experienced, which was a handful of black kids going into a white school. It was not the same thing as integration, which is a system of power sharing where the exchange goes both ways, where it's not just black kids having to sacrifice, but where truly it is, the school is reflecting the demographics of the district. It is not a handful of black kids going into an all-white setting, and there is power sharing. So I think we should specifically, if we want integration, we need to call it integration, because diversity doesn't mean anything. You can have 10 kids of another race and say that that school is diverse.
And you've written about how people want their little Model UN classroom. That doesn't necessarily mean that...
Right. It just becomes another badge of privilege for already privileged parents who can brag about how diverse their school is but haven't had to give up anything, and it's not actually providing equity for black and Latino students. I see integration as providing equity. I think we have been very afraid of that language. In New York City, they, a few months ago, released a so-called integration plan that never mentions the word integration nor segregation, and so therefore is not a plan. Just to quickly clear up the issue about the Supreme Court. So in 2007, I'm assuming you're talking about the Parents Involved ruling, which is the last time the Supreme Court ruled on desegregation, where it struck down two voluntary integration plans. The plurality decision, which was written by Justice Kennedy, actually says that you can use race under certain circumstances. Now, the Bush administration sent out guidance that said you can never use race. The Obama administration sent out guidance that corrected that, though a lot of school districts, including New York, chose to ignore that. What it says is that you can use race, but not of individual students. So you can draw attendance zones, you can look at the race of communities and draw attendance zones around a black community and a white community to make a school integrated. You can cite schools in ways that where you pay attention to race and they will integrate schools. So you can actually still use race. I think school systems who didn't really want to deal with desegregation anymore anyway latched on to that decision as an excuse about why they couldn't do anything. But that law actually does still allow you to take race into consideration. Just you cannot assign an individual student to a school based on the student's race.
Mm-hmm. We have time for about two more, so we'll go here and then here.
Okay. Hi, thanks for coming. My name is Adela Genovez, and I teach at Granite School District. It's also,
where?
I think the Granite. Right. It's here in the city.
It's similar demographics to Salt Lake.
But I think it may be the largest school district in the state, if I believe.
It's up there. They always battle it out between the big ones, yeah.
Yeah, and so I teach on the west side, and I teach science at the high school, one of the high schools. And I'm a proponent of public education, of course. And sometimes I've thought about charter schools and how I think that perhaps charter schools are a new way of segregation. And I wanted to get your opinion about that. And also about the new secretary, Betsy DeVos, and if she and, you know, her new policies, do they have the power to change a lot of things in education that might be detrimental to integration and progress? Okay.
Assuming that was a rhetorical question. I mean, I'm not going to give my opinion on charter schools, but the research shows that charter schools are more segregated than traditional public schools. However, I think that traditional public schools carry a lot of the blame for the rise of charter schools, because the inequality of traditional public schools
have made charter schools a very appealing option for Black and Latino parents whose only other choice is a failing public school. At least charter schools, even when they fail your kids, they act like they want your kid there. They send glossy brochures to your house. They invite you in. And so I think as long as we have the type of inequality we have in traditional public schools, charter schools are going to thrive. Because if you are a low-income Black or brown parent, you at least want to feel like you have a choice or a say in your kid's education. Most parents, no matter what their race, would prefer to send their child to a quality neighborhood school. And they wouldn't choose a charter school if they had a quality traditional public school choice. So I think we're going to have to deal with the inequality in our public system if we want... Hello? If folks don't want to see continuing proliferation of charter schools. The biggest problem with charter schools, of course, is they take public funds but are run by private, often for-profit entities that have no public accountability. And they just don't produce better results for our kids.
So that's where Salt Lake is actually really anomalous. We have one public charter. You can have a charter for lots of things. And the Salt Lake Center for Science Education, a part of their charter was to reflect the demographics of the district. And they stick to that ferociously and are deeply dedicated to making sure that every student gets an excellent experience. So it's an interesting lever where you can use a charter to do some really good work, but that's among a group of people who are committed to doing that work. Otherwise, I absolutely agree with Nicole's assessment.
Last question here.
So I'm gonna keep it really brief. I have a comment and a question. So I just was like interested in just what you were saying about like in conversations around like addressing race when we're talking about education, and like I was unclear, but you were saying something about like not needing to address it because it brings up feelings of guilt. And I guess I just wanted to comment. No, okay, like not for you, but like in addressing that, like sometimes like the more subtle way.
I'm sorry. I was saying that in teacher training, a lot of times when we are sort of run through when we run teachers through the mill of requisite multicultural education, that's brought to people as like the appropriate response is guilt and shame.
Okay.
And so it's like built into the training to then sort of minimize the potential efficacy of those folks coming out of that training.
Okay.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks. It's not necessary. I was like, I'm confused what you're saying.
Yeah.
So then it's like there's been a lot of interesting stuff in my head about. So I went to a public high school here. I went to West High School. I was in AP and IB courses, but I lived on the West Side. And so like the kids that I lived in the neighborhood with were not ever kids that I took classes with. And so when I was like a junior in high school, it just like got really toxic and racist in a lot of ways. And so I stepped out of IB into general population classes, and that was like a really interesting experience for me. Just having still white teachers, but like being a valued student because of like my education or the way that I speak. Even though like, I was a brown student, teachers would value me. I felt over other kids that I was taking classes with that grew up in my neighborhood. And so I don't know if y'all are familiar with Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, Revisionist History. I highly recommend it. It's really great. And he had a really awesome episode recently about the Brown versus Board Education ruling. And I was just, I don't know, maybe I missed this. Maybe you guys talked about that. You pointed. So I was just wondering, like, how do y'all feel about the idea that, like, that ruling centered white ideas about Black children and identity and, like, our fragility as opposed to centering, like, white institutions? And how do we... Like, is desegregation or is integration actually the goal, or do we instead want to be investing in, like, Black students having Black experiences with Black teachers who value them?
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I actually got into a bit of a Twitter conversation with Malcolm Gladwell about that episode. So, clearly in the perfect world, Black folks would be able to have Black institutions, and those Black institutions would be funded and treated the same as every other institution in this country. But that's just never happened for one day in this country. Right after slavery, Black people who were denied access to publicly funded schools did start our own schools. We did try to fund our own schools. Well, there's a huge wealth gap in this country. I think it is just impossible. And Brown was flawed for a lot of reasons. But the center of Brown was understanding that as long as you separate a marginalized minority from the majority in the ruling class, that you are separating those people from full citizenship in this country. And that's actually what Brown was fundamentally about, was citizenship. Most people, I mean, raise your hand if you've actually ever read the Brown v. Board of Education decision. So most people have never read the decision. Most people actually don't know what the decision says. The decision doesn't mention test scores. It doesn't mention resources. It doesn't mention schools. It mentions citizenship and racial caste. And it is understanding that that separation, that forced separation, denies Black Americans full citizenship, and that there is nothing more important in this country than education and the rights in education and equal access to an education. So I agree that if you are Black in this country, you're going to give something up, right? There will not be a perfect situation for us. There's never been. As a mother, I could decide, do I put my child in a white school where I know she'll get the best of everything educationally, but socially and culturally, she's going to be, like I was, an outsider, and it's going to be a struggle? Or do I put her in a Black institution where culturally and socially she will have everything, but that school is going to have less likely to have qualified teachers, to have textbooks, to have technology, to have safe buildings, to have clean water? You're going to give up something. So I don't think we can question Brown, because Brown was addressing forced segregation. It was not what we chose. It was not what we wanted. It was forced upon us. And we deserve to have a right to the same schools that white parents had. Not to mention, we were paying for those schools, right? Like, Black folks have been paying tax dollars to fund schools that their kids couldn't go to since there have been common schools in this country. So Malcolm Gladwell actually agrees with me. If you go back on Twitter, you'll see that what he was arguing was actually totally distinct from what the court was trying to do. Undoing racial caste in this country is the most difficult thing. And to think that any one ruling would get it right or be perfect, I think, you know, it's a folly. It wasn't going to happen, but that really needed to happen. And also what we know is Brown v. Board set up for the destruction of legal apartheid in every aspect of American life. Because once you struck down Plessy v. Ferguson saying separate was okay as long as equal in the schools, you had to then strike it down in every other thing. So that's why we can go to whatever restaurants we want to go to now. It's why we can use public parks. It's why we can use public libraries. All of that comes from the Brown ruling.
I'm sorry, we're out of time, but maybe you can
sorry,
get on
my
the panelists afterwards.
Yeah, I talk a lot, y'all.
No, yeah. It's okay. So we have to wrap up.
Just one quick.
She's like, I'm okay. She's reclaiming her time.
I want to wrap up all these stories. My name is Natalie Duarte, and I actually brought my kids here because I come from Miami, Florida, which I grew up in a diverse, multicultured, different economic backgrounds, schools. And I put my daughter in Little Haiti, where poor people lived. I lived in an urban farm in Miami, Florida. And they're right here. And she told me, Mom, you need to go up there and tell them what you did. Because I think that I am not the best parent, but I can say, and I just want to comment on all the conversations that we've had. I've read Dream Hoarders. I've read Race Talk. I've read a bunch of things. I love NPR. It's my inspiration. If it wasn't for that, I would not drive to Park City for 40 minutes to work. But what my point that I came up here is I grew up in that culture. And what I see as a problem is that students don't even know how to communicate within themselves. And maybe that's why we're not growing. Because if you see us as in a report, why are Latinos, me, I am a Latina, and Blacks not getting those test scores high? High test scores. I'm sorry, I'm so nervous. Because I see that anger in those kids. I lived with them. I was in a Black school. I was with Indians. I was with Asians. I see the anger in them. And maybe that's what the gap is. And I feel that my daughter even felt the repercussions. They would come to me, Mom,
They said I'm not white. Mom, they say I'm not black. What am I? Girl, you're you. That's it. We're not teaching those kids how to even communicate with themselves. How are we supposed to prosper? How are we supposed to grow as a community, as a nation, if our own kids cannot even communicate and accept other cultures? And that is taught at home.
Thank you. Well, our time is up. I would invite you, kind of, there's a lot of things I really loved hearing tonight. There's things that kind of unsettled me, and my invitation to myself and to you is that if you feel a little unsettled, is to do something about that, is to kind of lean into that discomfort. There's ways I want to report a little differently. There's things I want to do differently in the way I interview people. I hope there's ways that you want to approach your community, your family differently. Obviously, race conversations are not just going to happen. You make them happen. And we made one happen tonight, and I'm proud of you for being here, and I'm glad you showed up. And I want one last round of applause for our awesome panel.